And we are back with episode 723 of The Critical Myth. I'm John, your host, and tonight we have...
Edmund from Greenville, and of course 2016. You couldn't go by without a little visit into that particular cast, could you?
No, indeed, it apparently could not. And so we are here to, we're going to be starting off in some pretty... some unfortunate territory, I have to say. I'm not at all happy for us to bear this bad news. I'm sure that many people who are part of the Babylon 5 fandom are already well aware of what's going on, but we'll cover it anyway because it is what we do. But before we do any of that and get into the other news from this week, Edmund, if you don't mind giving a disclaimer.
Certainly. If you haven't heard this news, then you'll be spoiled by it. And we probably won't get into episode discussion, but if we do, you'd better have seen the episode because we'll spoil you about that too.
We're just going to spoil you silly regardless, so there we are. All right, well, we're going to go ahead, as we alluded to, with our In Memoriam section, and Edmund, why don't you go ahead and take this away?
Certainly. This was the news that just came in a day or so before we were actually recording this. It's been a while once it actually goes out, but this is the news that Jerry Doyle, best known for his role as Mr. Garibaldi on Babylon 5, died, this was last Wednesday. He was only 60, was found unresponsive in his Las Vegas home, unclear exactly how he died, autopsy is pending, but no foul play is suspected. Jerry was most well known for playing Garibaldi. He actually had worked on Wall Street before going into acting, but Garibaldi certainly seemed like his the dream role that he was just built to play. As mentioned, him currently living in Las Vegas, and has actually, I believe, for the last 20 years or so, it's been now has been a top conservative talk radio host based out of Las Vegas.
Yes, indeed. And of course, we might as well just go ahead and focus on the part that we know best. And that would be, of course, his time on... I'm sorry. This is literally the worst possible time for my cat to decide to wrap itself around my neck. Okay. A little levity here, I guess, for the moment.
Look out behind you. Yes.
Yes. Look out. Watch your back, Michael.
Yes.
Anyway. Yes, his role as Michael Garibaldi on Babylon 5. That was what most of us here know him best as or from. It's what most of us have seen him repeatedly through many, many viewings of the show in that role, and certainly a major part of that cast.
Mm-hmm.
And to be to really put it into perspective, I believe that Garibaldi is the one character that pretty much was one of the characters that was there from the start to the finish.
Absolutely. Yeah. One of the only.
Yeah. Yeah. There were only a couple, right? So, mm-hmm. I mean, we've got, one of the major fixtures of Babylon 5 has now moved on. As Edmund said, he went on to do other things in his life. One of the things that I remember Jerry Doyle doing, and one of the things that he would talk about many times, going back to his earliest days on the show and then many times after at various conventions and such, was the fact that he's the kind of person he was that would do something, and when he got a certain proficiency at it and he felt like he pretty much did everything that he was going to do, he then would move on. He's very much similar philosophy to what he did in life as Joe Michael Straczynski has been saying recently.
Mm-hmm.
He was if I recall correctly, he was he was on Wall Street for a few years, very early in his life, did pretty well at it, and then decided to move on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Tried out acting. Why not? Right.
Yep.
Pretty much went into the role of Garibaldi. I believe actually Gary wanted us to mention that he was kind of, I guess he was on Moonlighting, and maybe, do you remember exactly what that was about?
I do not recall, but it is an amusing aside, certainly given the well documented hair issues of both Mr. Willis and Mr. Doyle. So they did kind of wind up on similar paths, at least in the hair department.
Right, and I mean, if there's one thing about Jerry Doyle before I go on to the rest of his career that was probably infamous, it was the fact that he could, at least early on, he was a practical dead ringer for Bruce Willis.
Yes.
I mean, there were many people who thought, what is Bruce Willis doing on Babylon 5?
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, he of course did the acting thing. He mainly did the role of Garibaldi, and he might have done a couple little things here and there, but I really think that's the one that he did. He felt like once he did that role and he embodied it through to the end, that he kind of did what he wanted to do. And then he moved on, as Edmund said, into politics for a brief period. He did, I believe, run for office, and it was unsuccessful. And then he went into conservative talk radio, which he actually had quite a bit of success in the California market, I believe. I don't know how far he got out of that market. I really didn't follow him. I'm not a big talk radio guy, but ironically enough.
Yes.
He kind of moved from career to career as he felt he needed to, or his muse, or whatever you might have you took him. And certainly, while there were differences of opinion in terms of politics and such between, say, JMS and Jerry, they respected each other a great deal. Just about everybody on the cast respected him a great deal. Mm-hmm. Seeing their reactions this week to his passing has been made what it was already a really difficult piece of news that much harder to mm-hmm, take. Mm-hmm. I'm just right now remembering Pat Tallman's video, and we'll be moving on. Edmund, you can go ahead and pick it up from there.
Yeah, no, it certainly that was one thing that was very evident at the 20th anniversary convention that I went to in Phoenix. I mean, just the camaraderie that the cast still has, and but also, I mean, that Jerry's sort of in a way sort of unofficial role as master of ceremonies on these things, given his sort of just naturally sort of take charge personality, but it was also clear just how much the cast respected him and enjoyed working with him. And one of the stories that was brought out that I'd forgotten about was the whole thing of Jerry literally upbraiding guest stars who were not learning their lines and performing up to snuff and performing up to the level of the main cast, to the point of indeed physically roughing up one of the guest stars on one episode. Although, of course, for the rest of the shoot, he did show up on time and knowing all his lines. So.
Well, yeah, I would certainly hope so. Otherwise, why does the guest star look like he got in a fist fight? Rewrite.
Yes.
Yeah. But certainly, I mean, wow, this cast has had some fairly bad luck over the years. We have had the benefit of a few years here without I guess the last one was Michael O'Hare, right?
Yes.
A couple years ago?
Yep.
If even that long ago, now that I'm thinking about it, it might.
It was about 2 years ago, because of course it had happened just before that Phoenix convention, which is why JMS could finally reveal what was going on in season one.
Yes.
And why he had to leave the show. But, which you can look up on YouTube, because I'm not going to go into it now, and I'll probably start crying again if I do. Anyway.
Yeah, we don't. We that's a topic to revisit another time if necessary. But that is unfortunately another loss from the cast. And any other words, Edmund? I know that this is a rough place to start our week, but it did have to. I felt that it needed to be the lead item.
Yeah,
definitely. A lead item.
Absolutely. Well, I'm just. As we do keep losing more and more of the main cast, it's starting to feel like it's almost 50-50 now. I just hope he's having a rollicking time beyond the rim with whatever reshoots they're doing.
Yeah, that's right. The celestial reboot, yes, so to speak. All right, let's maybe get into something a little more uplifting.
Please. Absolutely. Yes.
Yes. All right. We're going to go with what was going to be our headline item for the evening, and that is Star Trek Beyond debuted at number one.
Okay.
There's a few things in this article, but topped by Star Trek Beyond, five films grossed over $20 million this past weekend. This would have been the weekend that Beyond premiered, of course, for the first time since May 24th, 2015, and only the sixth time ever. The estimated $59.6 million opening for Star Trek Beyond is enough to take number one for the weekend, but that's a 15% drop compared to the $70.1 million opening for Into Darkness. And that's not including the $13.5 million it carried into the weekend after opening on a Thursday.
Okay.
Goes on to say that Beyond has received strong reviews, opening day audiences giving it an A-, so forth, but that still is just off from the A of the previous installments.
Mm.
Okay.
Well, yeah, I was going to say I suspect there'll be better word of mouth and legs on this one, but we shall see.
Yes, that's correct. And there's more here, though, that I found interesting and why I wanted to have this as the lead item. Mm-hmm. As for projecting an overall domestic performance, Star Trek Beyond is probably looking at a domestic haul of around 180 to 190 million, a continued decline compared to the 228 million Into Darkness delivered and 257 million 2009's Trek took in domestically. Mm-hmm. However, given Beyond's $185 million budget, all eyes will now turn towards the film's international performance.
Exactly, yes.
All right, and this is where we start seeing that whole thing come up again. Let's see. By the way, just on that note, did you happen to notice all of the international studios that were behind or financing Beyond?
Oh, absolutely.
All those things
yeah.
at the beginning, the Chinese
yeah.
one, the
yep,
Middle
yep.
Eastern one, so
mm-hmm,
forth.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. No, that was quite intriguing. I was almost feeling like I was watching one of those European films that get funding from like six different countries.
Exactly. So, yes, that factors in, I'm sure, because... Take this into account. In the end, Into Darkness came in below 2009's Star Trek reboot domestically, but outperformed the 2009 film internationally by 110 million. By comparison, with an estimated 30 million international debut in 37 overseas markets, Beyond is playing 35% above Star Trek, but that's on my screen. 14% yep. below Into Darkness. So what mm-hmm. we're getting here is, and there's a whole bunch of explanation under this regarding the various markets and how they compared. It's still a bit below right now. But the main thing that they're saying here is that just like Into Darkness, just like so many films these days, it is the international haul mm-hmm. that is actually more important to investors than the domestic haul, which because it's all these international investors that are actually allowing these movies to happen. This film is a perfect example. Like I said, at the beginning, they pretty much said right off the bat, this is an internationally financed film, so yeah, they're courting the international audience, not just what I guess you could say is the traditional Trek domestic audience.
Mm-hmm. And certainly, I was going to say also, I mean, you know, I think that was certainly part of the impetus behind the reboot as well, was to relaunch it in a form that would play better overseas, and obviously has, given the results so far.
Exactly. Okay, so we can move on from that, but it is good to see that it came in at number one. I'm hoping that it continues to get that word of mouth, because even though it initially is kind of coming in below the previous two installments, I really do feel as though this is the best out of the three.
Oh, absolutely.
By far. Okay. Yeah. Now we can move all the way down to the CW. And of course, we have the news recently that The Vampire Diaries was going to be putting out its final season next year. Well, that could mean that Nina Dobrev could be making an appearance in the final season. Cast and showrunner Julie Plec sat down for an interview during 2016 Comic-Con, where they were asked what the odds were of Nina's return. Not to put too much pressure on anything Nina Dobrev, but a promise was made, an emotional promise that I'd like to see come to life. Uh-oh. You've heard it here. There's been friendship promises made, and now we'll see if we can deliver on them.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Yeah, well, it would certainly make sense to figure out some way for her to come back during the finale.
Exactly right. I mean, that is the way that this works, since it is supposed to be her story, even if she's not there right now. She's still prominently in the story.
Yep.
Just she's in a little bit of a coma. That's all. All right. Moving over to Cable. Last time, or last week, or the week before even, we had all this news about sci-fi and things being renewed, and we asked the question, well, what about Winona Earp, right?
Yes.
Because it was one of those shows that seemed to be at least... as far as reception, perhaps a little bit divided.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it has been renewed officially by Sci-Fi for a season 2. During the show's panel at Comic-Con, the cast and producers of Sci-Fi's Winona Earp announced the show has been renewed for a 10-episode second season. The first season of the show was 13 episodes long, so it is getting cut down a little bit. But the fact of the matter is, so are other shows that are on Sci-Fi getting a new season. So is that mean that it is kind of on the bubble, or does it just mean that Sci-Fi is starting to... maybe diversify the number of episodes and the length of seasons, because everybody is doing that these days? Not sure. Doesn't really matter. The second season of Winona Earp is set to premiere in 2017. Does it have anything else to say? Not really. Gives a kind of recap of the show, but we already know what the show is about, right? So, yeah, good news for fans of that particular program.
Yeah, now I get to decide if I want to catch up or not.
We have so many other things.
I know. Yes, exactly. Okay, well, meanwhile, over on Freeform, which is the renaming of something, and I can't remember what it was renamed from. Anyway, one of those renamed networks, they've greenlit a new pilot for a drama called The Deep, which promises to reinvent the very concept of mermaids. The one-hour project will focus on the battle between man and mermaids after these predatory creatures return to the town of Bristol Cove to reclaim their homes. Let's see, Carrie Burke, their Freeform's VP of Programming and Development, says The Deep is a very different show than one would expect when they hear the word mermaid. The mermaid tale has been reinvented in this pilot. The writing is thrilling, story is complex and scary, and we are excited to explore the themes of obsession and violence through these amazing creatures. We've got Emily Witzel will act as showrunner, worked on Finding Carter before. It's based on a story by Eric Wald and Dean White, who will executive produce, and Wald will write the pilot. So, yeah, this could be this sounds like a rather odd horror-tinged version of Mermaids, but if Sharknado can work for 4 movies and counting, who knows?
I kind of dig the idea that they're going a little with a horror vibe here. Certainly the channel that it's on probably lends itself to something a little more lighthearted, but even so, you could get some mileage out of the horror angle. And actually, Freeform seems to be trying to go there, even in some degree, with this Dead of Summer show they have right now,
right,
which
right.
is kind of a semi spoof I don't know if spoof is the word for it, but at least it's kind of like a nostalgic look back at slasher films of the 80s. Weird way of looking at it, but yeah.
Oh, yeah. No, I have heard some tell of that.
Yes. It's at least, but what I've seen definitely has a tongue firmly in cheek.
Yes.
All right. Next on, now this particular news I am very excited about. Legendary Digital Studios is going to be developing a digital series based on the video game Life is Strange. If you haven't played this game, I urge you to do so. It is really quite good. It's basically a lot like the Telltale games, like The Walking Dead, Game of Thrones, the Batman game that's about to come out. But this is the writing on this show is pretty excellent. So I loved playing it.
Okay.
Yes.
Interesting.
So the fact that they're going to have a digital series based on it, live action, I believe, is what it's going to be. Yeah. So, yes. Yeah, really excited. I'm not sure where it's going to actually go. But by the way, that game, Life is Strange, if you want to at least sample it just to see if it's something for you, the first episode is entirely for free on PlayStation 4, Xbox One, Steam, PlayStation 3, and Xbox 360. So, and on Steam, it's for Mac, PC, Linux, the whole gamut. So definitely I would recommend going out and doing that. So, yeah, please do. Please enjoy it. On to some comics news. I put it in comics news, even though it's really hard to see exactly where this.
Well, yeah.
Down.
Well, it's the all encompassing media conglomerates that sometimes constitutes comics news. This was news again out of Comic-Con, or was being bandied about at Comic-Con, but now confirmed that Geoff Johns can now add president to his job title at DC Entertainment, the promotion does not strip him of the title of chief creative officer, but instead adds to his responsibilities, reportedly at the same time he was promoted to overseeing the film side of things alongside veteran producer John Berg. His new official title is chief creative officer and president. We'll be reporting to President Diane Nelson over at Warner Brothers Interactive Entertainment. As we're somewhat familiar with Warner Brothers, it's not uncommon for presidents to answer to other presidents at Warner Brothers. He might be having his the usual interesting issues dealing with the multi-headed monster that is Warner Brothers.
Yeah, I know everybody is saying that this means that Geoff Johns is basically the Kevin Feige of DC, but I think the difference here is that Feige has a lot of trust put in him by Disney/Marvel.
Mm-hmm.
And will Geoff Johns get the same degree of latitude and support from Warner Brothers, or will the Hydra eat him alive?
Yeah,
that is the question. Tune in next time to find out.
Yeah, and of course, it does mention here that on the film side, his involvement is apparently ramped up while Suicide Squad was in post-production, which leads me to believe he was influential in all of that reshooting and re-editing they were doing, and with Wonder Woman and Justice League also heavily influenced by him. So the how Suicide Squad actually gets received may give us a early indication of what his reign is going to be like.
Yes, indeed. Okay, moving then on to movie news, and this is ambitious. The question is raised: does Disney have plans for a whole Han Solo prequel trilogy?
Okay.
A big rousing yes, because I think they probably
I was just going okay, but it wasn't necessarily rousing yet.
Okay, there are some people who are pretty excited about the notion, but for me, I would say, why don't we see the first one, mm-hmm. see how it does?
Yep.
Isn't this a little premature? But anyway, when the anthologies, now Star Wars Stories, air quotes, were announced, the intention would be that they were standalone one-off films. They told a story, and then they were done.
Right.
But a new rumor suggests that at least one of those stories, the Han Solo story, could develop into its own franchise.
Mm-hmm.
So the New York Daily News is reporting that when hiring Alden Ehrenreich to play the young smuggler, Disney actually signed him on for a 3-film deal. This means that the site's insiders claim that it's because executives at Lucasfilm and Disney are currently not just enchanted by his auditions, but the whole idea of the Han Solo film telling a wide variety of different types of stories within the universe that don't have to involve the hero fighting the Empire.
Mm-hmm.
So basically think, to bring this whole full circle,
yes.
Indiana Jones in the Star Wars universe.
Of course.
Right?
With maybe a little touch of Firefly thrown in, just to try and just to pull in the brown coats a little bit. But.
That's right. That's right.
Smugglers on the rim of the Empire, exactly.
Well, remember that it was the core worlds versus the outer rim, right?
Yep.
Kind of like the Star Wars galaxy.
Mm-hmm.
See, it parallels. So original. Anyway,
yes.
Speaking of original, or not?
This was news that Isaac Asimov's The Caves of Steel apparently is going to be, they're going to attempt to adapt it. I believe this has been tried a couple of times before, but wound up never really going anywhere. And this might be wonderful news, except that it was also announced that Akiva Goldsman was being hired to adapt The Caves of Steel after, of course, she may have won Oscars for writing A Beautiful Mind, but was also been involved in things like I, Robot. Which was a wonderful Will Smith sci-fi action movie, if you forgot that it was supposed to have anything to do with Isaac Asimov and the iRobot stories. So the question here is whether we will get something close to a faithful adaptation, or whether it will be iRobot time all over again.
I'm really hoping for the first.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the Cage of Steel, at least, I mean, it's sort of fundamental plot is a detective, odd couple detective story. So that's something pretty basic that Hollywood knows how to do pretty well. So I'm keeping my fingers crossed on this one.
Yeah, I don't know that the problem is that when it comes to films, the screenwriter is not really always the problem.
Well, so, yes, true.
Yeah, how much of it was rewrites and demands from the studio to insert this, take out that? And iRobot was really, as you said, not suited to adaptation for film, per se.
Mm-mm.
It's a more cerebral type of story or collection of stories. Caves of Steel actually is a pretty, I'm agreeing with you, essentially. Caves of Steel is more suited to adaptation, I think.
Yeah, definitely.
The world itself is more visually and thematically interesting. It's basically noir in space, so, with robots.
Absolutely.
Robot noir.
Yes.
Sounds like a type of oil. based wine.
and actually, I missed this, but yeah, apparently Caves of Steel was adapted back in 1964 as a TV movie by the BBC. But of course, that was during that period when they were not keeping copies and taping over things. So only a few segments of that production are actually still in existence.
Okay, interesting. All right. Moving on then to Aquaman. James Wan, the director of the film, is basically saying, said in his panel at Comic-Con, that based on the fact that he is known mainly for his horror film work on movies like Saw or The Conjuring or Insidious, he intends completely to bring that horror aesthetic to Aquaman as well. I'm not going to be able to quote him directly. But bleepin' Aquaman, what can I say? Aquaman's such an amazing character. I love the fact that he's never really been portrayed in the feature movie world before, and the opportunity to explore this universe, you know, bring a bit of my horror element into this. The deep sea is a scary world. And then also explore the wondrous world of Atlantis, that's all I have to say. And apparently that's all he really did say, because then he left. But that shows a certain enthusiasm, I think, for from him to say, take his horror stylings and bring it to something that is more mythic like this. And maybe that is an indication that the DC films are taking a little bit of a page out of the Marvel playbook and saying, yes, these are comic book movies, but each film should really have some kind of subgenre to it, which has always been something that the Marvel films have done very well.
Absolutely, yeah.
All right, next on our list here, Edmund?
Well, yeah, this sequel? Speaking of horror movies, this I'm sure comes as no surprise, but Lights Out, the independent horror film that just opened recently, was made for just under $5 million, has already grossed $27 million domestically and $35 million worldwide after its opening. So lo and behold, naturally, they are going to make a sequel. So I'm just trying to see exactly how much they've actually revealed, more that
could
it's...
Could you say, Edmund, that we're still in the dark about that?
Yes, I would, but if I flick the light switches, apparently something will appear before me and tell me that James Wan is going to be back as producer, Eric Heiserer will return to write the sequel, and Sandberg will direct it. So all the same folks, just presumably with a little bit more money this time, so...
One would think so, because if I recall correctly, I haven't seen the film, but from what I understand, this is in fact a kind of a feature length reimagining of that actually pretty neatly inventive short video that was going around Facebook and such like mm-hmm. a year and a half ago. They managed to make it into a film, and from what I've heard, people love it. They say it actually really works because it is such a simple concept that everybody can get something out of.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes simple is best, and it seems like it's working out here for that. So, hey, good for them.
Absolutely.
All right, next on the list, something else from you.
Yes, from something that got a sequel after only being in existence for a year and a half or so, as John was just saying, we now have word that The Rocketeer will actually get a sequel. This is what, now 25 years after the original movie came out. It's actually one of those movies that is a personal favorite of mine, and one of those ones that I do feel gets overlooked, as it really was sort of classic updating of the Saturday Adventure serials. This Hollywood Reporter broke the news. The description of the project is this will be set 6 years after the original Rocketeer and after Cliff Secord has vanished while fighting the Nazis. An unlikely new hero emerges, a young African-American female pilot who takes up the mantle of the Rocketeer in an attempt to stop an ambitious and corrupt rocket scientist from stealing jetpack technology in what could prove to be a turning point in the Cold War. We got Max Winkler and Matt Spicer are writing the script, and Brigham Taylor producing along with Blake Griffin and Ryan Khalil. Flipping the genders, I'm sure, will push all the usual buttons among that small minority, and for the rest of us, I really like the original, and I hope they pull off a good sequel.
Yes, indeed. Okay, let's see. Next on the list we have the Uncharted movie is once again being charted with a brand new writer. Writing about a movie based on the hit game series Uncharted. Stop it, dog. Let's try this one more time. Rumbling about a movie based... Okay. Okay, I think we've got that under control now. Rumbling about a movie based on the hit game series Uncharted have come and gone over the years, so it's no surprise that now, hot off the heels of the latest game, the film adaptation is gearing up once again. Variety reports that Sony has hired Joe Carnahan to write the latest version of the film. Best known as the writer and director of Narc, Smoke and Aces, and The Gray, Carnahan is currently getting set to direct Bad Boys 3. Due to that commitment, he currently isn't planning on directing Uncharted, just writing it. If anything gets delayed, though, he could do both. Uncharted is basically a modern version of Indiana Jones, for those who have not played the games. If you haven't, you should go and do that now. Right after you play Life is Strange. I'm giving you basically orders to play a whole bunch of games. So it stars, of course, Nathan Drake, who goes off on adventures to mythic worlds to find precious artifacts and usually ends up needing to shoot a lot of bad guys. So, yes, it's a pretty action-packed game, so it makes sense that they would find someone who is action-packed in terms of his film stylings.
Indeed.
All right. So, next on our list, I do believe that we are moving into... casting news. That's right. And Edmund, you are up first.
Yes, this is casting news for Spider-Man Homecoming. It has been revealed that Tony Revolori has been cast as Peter Parker's high school nemesis, Flash Thompson. Role that had been rumored since his casting was announced is now confirming that is in fact the character he is playing. In a subsequent interview, also introduced co-stars Laura Harrier and Jacob Batalon as Liz and Ned, who are pretty sure means Liz Allen and Ned Leeds from those early classic Spider-Man comics. Some casting still up in the air. Ms. Zendaya's role remains a bit of a mystery, referred to only as Michelle, which has led to speculation, but nothing concrete yet. And assuming all goes according to plan, Spider-Man Homecoming will be out in a little under a year, in early July 2017.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and next on our list, we have some news from Supernatural Season 12. Whoa, there's a video on that one. All right. We're just batting 1,000 here. All right, Lucifer is going to rock out on the next season of Supernatural. That's right. At the San Diego Comic-Con panel on Sunday, it was revealed that musician Rick Springfield will be joining the cast as one of Lucifer's new vessels. Did you just react to that now? Hello?
Yes.
Okay. Lucifer got what he wanted last season, his face-to-face with God. Now he's out in the world. We see Lucifer on vacation, and he wants to have fun. This is a real role. Great actors who have played this before, like Mark Pellegrino and Misha Collins a bit.
Just a little bit, yes.
Yes. Most rock stars can only sing, and very few can act.
Mm-hmm.
But apparently he's been on things like The Flash and True Detective recently, so yeah. There you go.
Yeah, I think this could work.
Actually. Yes, indeed. All right. Let's see. What is up next? Here we have...
Yeah, this is news from the Flash movie. Not the DCW TV universe, but no. Of course they are completely recasting, and we now know that Iris West in the movie will be actress Kiersey Clemons, who has appeared in Dope. The most recent director for The Flash, after the original director parted ways over creative differences, is in fact the director who helmed Dope. Production is expected to commence sometime this year. It's expected to still meet its planned start date. Flash still on track as we speak.
Okay. Next, we have some news regarding... Uh, excuse me, Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. They have cast, Lily Birdsell in a recurring role for season four. Birdsell is joining the Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. in a recurring role, playing Lucy, a beautiful woman with a haunting quality. She has a very violent streak in her inner self because of things that have happened. Okay.
Okay. Well, that's only about 94% of the cast, but anyway.
Right. Wow. Okay. Intriguing, I suppose. Huh. All right. Let's see here. Next on our list.
Yes. So this is even though John is the one who actually is watching this show, but this is news about the originals. They are adding Neil Jackson, who was on Sleepy Hollow in recent seasons. He will recur on the upcoming fourth season of the originals. Little known about his character at the moment, save that he is a vampire named Alistair who will interact with Klaus. Yes, hoping that that does not, in fact, involve a beheading, as apparently it often can in those circumstances. Apparently season four will be picking up 5 years after the events of the season three finale. That's quite an intriguing time jump, actually. So anyway, over to you, John.
Yeah, that time jump is actually something that is really going to play very interestingly in this whole storyline, because I think if the originals is going to continue on after the Vampire Diaries ends, that's the kind of thing that they need to do. All right, so as I'm trying to get this to open, we're technical difficulties, animals going crazy, we've got it all here today in this episode. Anyway, Matt Ryan will be voicing Constantine. Not Yay. On another season of the show itself, but rather in the animated film for Justice League Dark.
Oh, okay.
Yes, Matt Ryan was given the opportunity to play Constantine one more time during a guest appearance on Arrow. Ever since NBC canceled that, however, in 2014, folks have been clamoring to see Ryan reprise his role. Now, later this year, they will get another unexpected chance to witness Constantine in his animated debut. So, yes, Ryan said here at Comic-Con, I believe, once again, I really wanted to jump into this project to play Constantine in a different context around some of the icons that are in the DC Dark world. Interesting to note that the producer of Arrow kept saying that Constantine's appearance was a one-time only deal, yet he was constantly referenced throughout the fourth season.
Yes.
So the CW recently picked up the streaming rights to the first and only season, so perhaps there is still a chance for Ryan to return to the character in one of the other DC superhero dramas.
Indeed. He can sign one of those I'm appearing on all four series for X number of episodes.
That's right. Okay, next on the list is some news out of The Handmaid's Tale. The Handmaid's Tale.
Yes, which is being done over on Hulu, but it is news that Samira Wiley, who is currently on Netflix's Orange is the New Black, has joined the cast, one of those usual, do we actually ever get to what her role is? What we do know is Handmaid's Tale is starring Elizabeth Moss, of course, from Mad Men, here we go. Wiley will play Offred's best friend from college, her fellow handmaid in training at the Red Center, and a connection to life before Gilead. Pretty prominent supporting role there.
Mm-hmm. All right. Let's see here. Next on the list, we have some news out of Blade Runner 2.
Okay.
If it will open. Come on, this is almost like as if Bronstein were back on the show. Blade Runner 2 adds The Walking Dead star Lenny James. The jury is still out on whether or not a sequel to Blade Runner is a good idea in the first place. Do you want to hear our opinion? Would you like to hear more? But I'll say this much. The director has been assembling a cast that certainly makes it look like a good idea. And I will admit, the cast does look great.
Absolutely.
The latest actor to join the increasingly large ensemble is British character actor Lenny James, best known to audiences for playing Morgan Jones on The Walking Dead. James joins the cast that already includes, of course, Harrison Ford returning to the role of replicant hunting detective Rick Deckard, and Ryan Gosling playing the mysterious second lead of the film. Plot details remain tightly guarded, but we do know it will take place decades after the events of the first film, which was released in 1982 but took place in a dark and dystopian Los Angeles circa 2019.
We haven't quite gotten there yet.
Yeah, we've got a couple years to catch up, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Some people who think that that's what it looks like all the time, right?
But okay. wait, but where is our flying car, damn it? But...
Yes, that's a good point. Good point. All right, next on the list is some news regarding The Man in the High Castle.
We have learned that Tate Donovan has been cast in a recurring role for season 2 of Man in the High Castle. Plot is mostly under wraps, but he will play a character named George Dixon, a mysterious figure from Juliana's past. Premiere date has not yet been set for the series' return. Naturally, they gave people a sneak peek at Comic-Con last week. And Donovan most recently co-starred in Elvis and Nixon, will be appearing in Manchester by the Sea, and certainly from some of his recent work on particularly Damages, playing the harried and put-upon partner to Glenn Close's extraordinary lead character. He is quite good playing shifty guys who might be playing things against the establishment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right, and that brings us to our final piece of news, and that is regarding some Dark Matter casting. And Chris Holden Reed from recently Lost Girl is going to be joining the cast, right beside Zoe Palmer, who plays the android, and formerly on Lost Girl, Dr. Lauren Lewis.
Yes.
Well, it
seems to be Dark Matter's firm conviction at this point to get all of the people who have appeared on recent Canadian science fiction series. You know, I'm waiting for Rachel to come on as a guest star.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's see here. Holden Reed will be appearing as Galactic Authority Chief Inspector Kirkin in the sci-fi space drama starting this week. Both shows, it should be no surprise, are productions of Prodigy Pictures headed by Jay Firestone.
Yes.
Chris was excited to be on the set again, not just to work with Zoe, but the rest of the cast was excited to work with Chris as he is a true professional. The crew welcomed him back as well because on Lost Girl, he was always one of the most fun off camera too. The executive producer Joseph Malazzi confirmed that Holden Reed's character will be a recurring role despite his somewhat self-contained story in a recent episode.
Okay.
Good to know.
Absolutely.
All right. And that is it then for this particular piece of news or news segment. Wow.
Just one of those weeks. Yes.
It is one of those weeks. It really threw me off completely, but there we are. Let's see. We're going to go ahead next time and get into our episodic discussion. And then, we should have some time for some open topics later this week as well. So until then.
And so ends another epic episode of The Critical Myth. If you want to leave a comment for this show, head over to vognetwork.com. Not only can you find links to the podcast version of each show, but there is a dedicated forum, a ton of written reviews, and related articles by the crew throughout the site. For the written reviews, you can even leave your own review, so let us know if you agree or not. You can also leave comments on our Facebook page, Critical Myth, on Twitter at Critical Myth, or Google Plus under The Critical Myth Show. Any and all use of copyrighted material is only intended for discussion, commentary, parody, or educational purposes, in accordance with U.S. Code Title 17, also known as Fair Use. In other words, please don't sue us. And of course, the statements and opinions of the Critical Myth crew are not necessarily those of the VOG network, its partners, or affiliates, but let's face it, we're probably right anyway. Until next time, watch, read, and listen, and believe in the critical myth.